Good morning, everyone. I'm excited today for our speaker that is joining us today, Dr. Amanda Nicholson, who is the Associate Dean of Undergraduate Programs and the Professor of Retail Practice at Whitman School of Management. But very recently, she was appointed as Assistant Provost and Dean for Student Success. Nicholson is a native English woman, spent over 20 years in the retail management field before entering higher education. She began her career with Marks & Spencer in London and then moved to Chicago to work in a variety of department store management positions, attaining the position of vice president over two apparel divisions and opening a successful new store concept for her organization. She has taught a variety of retail classes, including retail fundamentals, apparel production development, and sales management. She continues to consult for the retail industry, and her commentary has been featured in a variety of outlets, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and CNN.com. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Amanda Nicholson.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me here this morning, Eileen. This is a true pleasure. I'm going to go in classroom mode here a little bit, so because that's the way I go back. I've prepared some slides to try and illustrate some of the points I'm going to hope to make, and then I think we have some time open for questions at the end, which is probably much more fun. But I think if you look at what's being written in the news today, you'll get a feeling that really the rumors of brick and mortar's death are out there, and I would just like to propose to you this morning that the rumors of its death are somewhat exaggerated, and try and explain that to you, and then maybe we could talk about your perspective. So let's start with a few facts, maybe. First of all, one of the facts that's really interesting is the amount of retail space in brick and mortar we have in the U.S. So, and you may be aware of this, but we have a lot of retail space in the U.S. We have about 23 square foot per person in the U.S., okay, which means that we lead the world in sales, in retail square footage, by about five times any other country in the world. So that's the first hint as to why we may be closing some brick and mortar stores right now, because I think it would be fair to say in many cases we're very over-retailed in terms of the amount of square footage we have. Secondly, I think technology continues to advance, and I'm sure most of you, if maybe by a show of hands, have actually bought something online in the last year. How many of you purchased something? Okay, so you get the drift. So now there are other channels in which you can purchase things, particularly online. The fact is, though, would you like to guess how much of last year's total retail sales were purchased online as a percentage? Any thoughts? 35, gentlemen with 35, do I have an advance on 35? 55, Eileen's 55? All right, the answer is 11.7%. Yeah, so it's really interesting. So hence the rumors of death being somewhat exaggerated. Okay, we're around 12%. It is the fastest growing channel in retail for people to purchase goods and services, but it's not what perhaps the press would make you think it is. Do you know what I mean? I constantly hear this phrase, everybody's buying everything online, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, not really. You know, that's actually not quite true. So I want to talk about who is shutting their doors physically and why they're shutting them, just to give you some background into why this is happening. And it's not only about online, okay? So it is, there is online as part of this, but it's not only about online. So it's generally considered that everybody is shutting their doors, and I'm going to hopefully disabuse you of that fact. Not everybody is shutting their doors. Some people are actually opening new stores, believe it or not. Okay, so not everybody is shutting doors. And most of the retailers that are shutting doors are those who are relatively established and older retailers who've been around a long time. And they have a lot of real estate, which is frankly not in the right places anymore. So they built stores traditionally attached to malls. So we're talking here like a JCPenney or a Sears or a Kmart. So many of their stores were built attached to malls in areas which were thriving when they were originally established, and unfortunately now are no longer thriving, right? So particular areas like in the Northeast are very overstored, because when the Northeast was settled with malls, there was a significant larger population here than there is now, right? The aging demographic has meant that many people have moved down further south to Arizona and Florida. And if you visit those states, you will notice that there is still building of retail there going on, though very little going on here, because it follows where the population moves. So when you hear that Macy's or JCPenney is shuttering doors, there are some other reasons for this, but part of it is because those specific doors are no longer viable for them. So they have the capacity to figure out what your profitability is by individual store nowadays, right? And so they can say, okay, these stores are not paying their way. So like any business, they have to decide whether to stay open or not. And in many cases, they're closing them in order to make their whole business more profitable while they are growing their businesses online. So that's going on quite a lot of time. Okay, so about more than half, something like 60% of the closures are actually attributed by the three stores I just mentioned. So that they are the vast majority of what's going on. And there are some other factors. So sadly, this week, I don't know if you heard, a Toys R Us announced that it was filing for Chapter 11 and restructuring. One of the problems here, it was another problem, besides older stores, and Toys R Us is not that old an organization, but they did have some weak real estate, which they're going to close anyway. But the other thing that factored into this sort of perfect storm, so you've got old real estate, then you've got the growth of online, and there's another factor that came in here, which is somewhere around 10 years ago or so, and then certainly 9 years ago, when the Great Recession hit, many large chain retailers were actually bought up by private equity firms. The concept was that they were going to be turned into IPOs. There was going to be an IPO and everyone was going to get very rich. Well, what happened was that they didn't get very rich. They didn't turn, things didn't go as planned because online was coming up. People got nervous. These stores were left with huge debt burdens, which they have been trying to pay off. So a company like Toys R Us, which is a very well-run company with a very new and dynamic CEO who we hope will turn it around, was in a position where if it didn't have the debt burden, it was actually making money. But the debt burden was so high that it couldn't actually make money. And more importantly, it could not invest in the sorts of things it needed to do to become a modern cutting-edge retailer. It was stuck in this old model, and its online was poor, and they knew it was poor. I'm not trying to knock a colleague here. Their online delivery was poor. They didn't have the right technology, because that costs a lot of money, putting up a great website. As a consumer, we click on and we expect things to work perfectly, and if they don't, we get very irritated. Behind that working perfectly is an army of people and a ton of cash to make this work. It's not the same as building your own website. This is like a big deal, building an e-commerce site and having it with the kind of rigor and the strength it needs to hold up a whole consumer marketplace tying onto it. So that was part of it. So we've got weak financials happening for the last 10 years, the growth of online, and then aging real estate all coming together, I think, to create this rather negative pattern that we're seeing in the press, which makes people feel, oh, Lord, you know, there's never going to be a store to shop in. But as I said, it's 11%, 11.7%. So where we are now, I think, is in a time of upheaval and transition. It's a big transition time, but if you can't tell, I'm a very optimistic person. So in my family, which was a big Winnie the Pooh family, I'm Piglet. Okay, so I constantly bounce up and down and think that the weather's going to be fine and everything's going to be great. So this is, of course, not a necessarily objective opinion, but I believe that in a time of transition, an upheaval, business actually usually then creates something fabulous, because that's when we have to, right? When we really have to, people think of things that are going to make shopping or any experience compelling. Okay, so that's where we are right now. We're in a time of transition where many retailers who are doing fairly well are looking very hard at what it is that makes people want to come to them and buy things, on what it is that makes them want to be online and buy things, and why. And another interesting thing that research has found is that the best customer for any retailer is the one that does both. They buy online, they buy in store, they buy on their phone, they buy by catalog. If you could buy on all the different channels they give you, you will be their best customer. That's just a fact. We know that. So it's not like we're going one or the other. Do you know what I mean? It's not like I'm going to stick to a store or I'm going to stick to online. That's not really where it is. There are, however, categories that are easier to sell online than others, right? So apparel has taken a big hit. So the stores that I mentioned that are closing are very apparel dominated. So it's taken a big hit online. Other categories have not taken such a big hit. Most people are not buying food online. Most of us still want to go to a grocery store and pick up, you know, the orange and make sure it feels right. You know, there's still things we want to do. Besides which, buying groceries online is an expensive proposition if you've tried it. So what do we want? Well, there's certain things we clearly want. We want convenience and time-saving things. We're time-poor society, and everybody wants to do things twice as fast as they did it before and get it there instantly. I always say that if we could click, put it in my bag, and press, yes, I'll place my order, and if the item could pop out of our printer, we would be really happy. That's really where we want to get to. But we haven't got there quite yet. So we have time and convenience is a big push, all right? We also find that for those retailers who are doing well in store, in brick and mortar, what most of us really want, and always have, by the way, is some kind of engagement in that store that makes the visit worthwhile. Not just buying the thing, but actually having an experience that makes it worthwhile. So we want store engagement. We also want unique products. I think what happened with the over-retailing of America, and I think most of you might nod in agreement, was that you would go from one mall to another and everything looked suspiciously the same. Do you know what I'm saying? So that you could be anywhere in the country and you go like, oh, here we are, the same things I saw in Syracuse. Oh, here we are, the same things I saw in Albany. Here, you know, I think that is part of the overassortment. So we were looking for things that are different, right, that make a compelling reason for us to go. We're also becoming more conscious of local things. We like local products. We like things that are perhaps not given, not everywhere the same, not everything is the same. And one thing we know, particularly for Generation Y, the millennials, and for Generation Z, who have just entered the university, they like experiences when they go shopping. They like something to happen, not just to have things hanging or sitting around that we're going to purchase. They like things happening inside the places. So they like these experiences, right? They like to go in. And an example of this would be a retailer like I don't know if you're familiar with it, but like a Lululemon. Have you heard of Lululemon? Where you not only buy the most expensive workout leggings you've ever seen in your life, but you also actually can work out in them at the back of the store, okay, which is sort of like, okay, so now we have a retail store that's part gym, part store, right? These kinds of experiences are very much what at least the younger generations are looking for, because that gives them a reason to actually go. Otherwise they could just buy the leggings online. But this gives them a social reason to go out there. So stores and retailers are looking very closely at what will we do with our brick and mortar to draw you in, to make you feel that this is a great place to come, right? That it's more than just a purchasing operation, it's an experience as well. And when we are buying online, we want to have things that are seamless in terms of omni-channel, right? So that we can get the same look on a mobile phone than we can on a tablet, than we can on a computer, and that all of this is somehow connected. That, again, is an extremely expensive proposition where some of the retailers have not been able to keep up with this because it's really expensive. So I'm going to show you a few people who are coming up with new ideas, which I hope will restore your faith in the fact that the age of retailing is still alive. So first of all, Target. I don't know if you're familiar with Target, one of my favorites. So Target is a really interesting company. It is really the sort of the chic discounter in the marketplace, right? It's definitely a discounter, but it's differentiated itself from the massive Walmart by saying, we're going to do this inexpensively, but we're going to do it with a little different bit of an edge on it. They have been losing some of their ground in the last year or so. But what they've done is say, okay, we can't keep putting out the same product and expecting people to keep loving it over and over again. People want things to move. So they've taken a huge risk. They have taken away, actually disbanded some of their most favorite lines, some of the brands that they grew up with, right? And they're replacing them. And they have invested a fortune in 8 brand new product lines that they're bringing out, 4 of which are already on the market right now. And if you've been involved in developing a product line, this is an enormous investment, But they're saying people are getting tired, they're seeing the same things, we need to rethink what we're doing. And they're doing it. So they've got a women's apparel, a menswear, a new home, and an athleisure, because they've athleisure, that's what Lululemon's kind of business is called. Everyone's into athleisure now. If you don't have anything in athleisure, go buy something if you want to be really hip. Okay. But they're also investing something like $7 billion in upgrading stores. It's not all online. They're going into their stores and they're going like, how do we make this look better? And some of the things they started to do were very smart. When Target invited Starbucks to come into its stores and take a corner, that was one of the smartest things it ever did. Why? Well, the gentlemen in this room particularly will know, because they're not generally very fond of schlepping around a store, okay? But if you could pop me in a corner with a cup of coffee, I'll be just fine, dear, and leave me here till you're done. Okay, so this makes the whole thing actually family friendly. There's a place where the kids can get a hamburger or whatever. So they were a little ahead of this idea that you need to make it a place where people can actually go and hang. So that's Target. Another one is a very lovely store based in New York called Saks Fifth Avenue. Now, Saks is a sort of old lady of retail. It's looks to a much more affluent customer. It's a niche market. The store itself is a temple to retail. It's all beautiful. It's mahogany and carpets and chandeliers. It's gorgeous, okay? But what was happening, people weren't coming in enough, and they're on Fifth Avenue. They're in the middle of New York City, all right? So they have a lot of tourist business, which New York has, but they still wasn't enough. So what are they going to do to make Saks an experience? Well, they recently opened 16,000 square foot of their second floor into something called The Wellery. It's a terrible name, I think, but I shouldn't say that. Anyway, W-E-L-L-E-R-Y, but it means well as in health and wellness, okay? And this Wellery place has everything you could possibly want to do with being healthy and beautiful. I'm checking in tomorrow, and I'm not coming out for 2 weeks. Anyway, so it has all kinds of things. It has boot camps, nail studio. So they're actually jumping up and down in one corner, getting their mani-pedis in another. They have guided meditation, sounds good, in another one. And they have something called cool sculpting, which I believe I probably need. That's happening somewhere else. So they've taken a big chunk, 16,000 square feet, and they've invested heavily into a place where people can actually go. So that's the Wellery, anyway. Pottery Barn is also coming up. Pottery Barn, the home furnishings retailer. Pottery Barn is actually owned by Williams-Sonoma. It's the same company, okay, so out of the West Coast. And they've worked out on their on an iPhone, so that you can use an iPhone. this is very clever. They have worked out the technology that you can take a picture of the room in your house that you're trying to put furniture in, for example, right? So you take a picture, imagine you just rented an apartment or you're building a new home or you just bought a home and you've got this and you're trying to think, I think we need a new sofa. Okay, so you take a picture of the room and with the technology they have, you can pop in all the different sofas or chairs or coffee tables into your picture as you go, you know, which is just amazing. So you can look and see what this will look like. Okay. And then, you know, and you can do it while you're in the store. So you're sitting on the sofa, right, checking that it's got the right leg thing and it's comfy and granddad will be okay and all the other things that concern you. But at the same time, you can see exactly, and it does it, it scales it to the measurement of your room too, so that you can see exactly how much room you'd have for a coffee table or a side table or a lamp or whatever. This merging of technology with the product, and really a clever idea. So Crate & Barrel has done something equally well, another smaller, more nimble company, right, who does have cash. They were fortunate. They only have about 140 stores, so they didn't have old stores hanging around the place. They're based in Chicago, very nimble company. So they actually have developed technology which, you know, you don't notice it, except it's very convenient as a customer, but how it had to come about was a huge investment. But what you can do is in the store, everything you click on your phone is in real time. So you can click on a registry item you're going to buy for someone, and it takes it out of the registry for that person instantaneously on all their systems. So everything is completely up to date. You can purchase it instantly. It is the easiest system ever. It looks like to us, well, of course that's how it should be. It's not easy to make these things work, and they spend a lot of time investing in it. But for their customer, their registry business is key for them. Their wedding and gift registry business is absolutely key. That's what really drives them. So they're another one. I don't know if you ever go to an Ulta Beauty store. Well, they have the same kind of concept as Sephora. Have you heard of Sephora? So Sephora broke the old-fashioned idea of cosmetics only being outside of the drugstore. Higher-line cosmetics were really only available in a department store. They used to lead off on the main floor, generally with the Clinique counter right in the front. Estee Lauder owned that space in pretty much every department store in America, right? And then Lancôme and everybody else would gather around. And there would be ladies selling you this makeup, right? And you really weren't allowed to touch anything. They would tell you and have little cotton balls and swabs and things and do things all over you, you know. Or sometimes they'd put you in a chair in the middle of the thing. I don't know why anyone ever does that. But anyway, so Sephora broke the mold and said, you know, people actually like to play with things. They like to play with makeup. There's not a woman in this room, I bet, didn't play with their mother's makeup when they were about 8 years old. This is something we all do. It's a ritual with girls. Okay. And I bet your grandchildren still do it and your children. So you still want to do it. So they created a store where everyone was allowed to touch everything. And you actually had samples on the end of the end caps. And you were actually allowed to use it. You would use the stuff. And they found, contrary to what people would think, well, you're going to waste a whole bunch of product and they'll never buy. Not true. They wasted a very small amount of product and it wasn't a waste because people did buy it. So Ulta took that idea and now they also own another beauty chain, which not only sells product, but kind of like the Wellery idea in Saks Fifth Avenue, they also have a salon in the back, right? So they do hair, they do nails, they do everything in there. So it's like a sort of spa meets a store. So it has this whole experience piece in as well, which I think was a really brilliant idea. And they're opening more stores as well. So they're keeping going because they can see that this is a new way that women are enjoying buying cosmetics. Okay, so that's Ulta Beauty. In terms of local and unique products, I'm looking at food here as an example. So the two big ones who have done this are both Whole Foods, who really started this trend, where they said, there's definitely a trend. They picked up on the trend that people like actual real things. They like real food. They like local food. They're actually prepared to pay more for it if it tastes like the food was supposed to taste like in the first place. And they built their entire business around this concept, okay? Walmart actually, in fact, Whole Foods has a system where you can actually apply to be a vendor online. If you have something you want to sell there, they will actually look at you instantaneously. Walmart now sells about $750 million of local products in their stores a year. So they got onto this bandwagon too in a major way. Okay. And they believe not only does it provide a better product and, helps them become part of the neighborhood, but also sort of builds goodwill, which I think it really does, that we're supporting local farmers and, and growers, and that's a really great idea. So Whole Foods now, as you know, has just been bought by Amazon. Okay, so Amazon is a really fascinating story, and we have no idea where it's going to go. I wish I knew the answer, and I could, be a fortune teller, and then probably make a fortune if I knew what was going to happen. But we're not sure. What we think Amazon may be doing is buying Whole Foods as a place, because they need a marketplace for food, and they have this new concept called Amazon Go. Amazon Go is a store where you go through and you're already signed up for their card. And every time you pick something up, it immediately goes onto the app with your phone and charges it. You walk out of the store without hitting a cashier at all. I've watched the process a couple of times. Personally, I think, for a piglet, it lacks a lot of interaction with people. It's not my kind of deal. I think it's wonderful for a convenience store kind of concept where you're going to run in and out, let's say at a gas station, and try and grab something. Do you know, once you've filled up the car on a journey, I don't think I'd like to buy my food that way, but that's just personal. But does it have a place in the retail marketplace, maybe in busy urban cities? I think it may well do. So that's what people are thinking they may be using some of their stores for. They're buying real estate when they bought Whole Foods. What people who love Whole Foods are concerned about, that Whole Foods will retain what it's already stood for, which is this high quality and high touch experience. So there's a lot of transition, and what it means right now is that, frankly, entrepreneurial management is an absolute premium. Absolute premium. People are buying people in, literally buying people in, to help run their retail establishments who have no retail background at all, in the sense that they're not really trained as merchants. So traditionally in retail, the merchants became the CEOs. That's how it worked. If you were a really strong merchant, you work your way up and up and up, and you would become the CEO, hopefully, one day. They're buying in people who have not got that sort of background. So Macy's has just brought in a president whose background is in eBay. He's not a merchant. He has no product background whatsoever, but he does have a huge technology background, and they're trying to figure out how to use that. We're looking at, therefore, a whole bunch of new HR requirements. Who are we going to get into the field? A lot more technology-driven people will be coming into retail now to come up with ideas that can seamlessly connect the in-store, the online, the mobile, all those experiences in a way that we like. We're looking at a lot of expertise and a lot of innovation. There's a lot of technology that people try. I think there's something like 1,000 apps produced every day, and 999 of them nobody wants, by the way. Just because it's an app, it doesn't mean it's any good. We've got to figure out things that make sense for the consumer that she and he like. We've also got to look at marketing in a different way to meet our needs. So if for the online shoppers, we've found it very clever, retailers have found very clever, that if you identify something and you linger on it and you look at it and you possibly put it in your shopping bag and then you think, maybe not, that item will follow you around like a stalker for the next 3 days. You can't read an article on the New York Times without that pair of shoes popping up. I don't know about you, but it's driving me crazy. I'm just not going to buy those shoes just because now, because you're irritating me. Do you know? It's like, stop stalking me with the things I was looking at. So not all technology is good technology, and they're finding that out because it's getting a little bothersome sometimes. We've got to have financing of new ventures. They're putting a financing package together for Toys R Us right now. There's a JP Morgan group putting it together to see if they can get them into a place where they can get through this year and move on. And they will have to come up with a business plan that I would suggest has some differences from just having a store with toys in it. We're closing the inefficient real estate because we have to, and we would have had to anyway. I'm going to tell you, it's just gone faster now with the advent of online. And we're revising the current footprints, like Target is doing, to make them more compelling for us to come into. And we have to provide a lot of supply chain for this new model, which is the biggest single challenge. The logistics of doing this is the biggest challenge for retail. Let me give an example. I'm in a store in Syracuse. I walk in, I like this jacket, except they don't have my size. Okay, I want this jacket, and this particular store, let's say, has 400 stores across the country. They have none online in my size, but I can bet you they have this size in this jacket somewhere in the country. How do they find it? How do they get it to me in 2 days? And how do they do it without them losing money? Because if the retailers lose money doing these sorts of things, they won't be in business, right? They have to make some sort of margin. So the logistics of how you manage your SKUs is probably the biggest single challenge in a retail landscape like we have, where we have so many national players. And last but not least, it's changed accounting in retail enormously because of the new third-party arrangements with companies like Amazon, right, where it's a very complicated model. They're not complicated, but it's a very new model they're running, where they're not actually making most of the product they're selling you. They're a delivery system to you. Okay. But I think to close, and then we'll open up, I hope I'm not running over to, I think if you take away anything, retail's not dead. It's in a time of tremendous transition. Those who are going to win at this are ones who are going to be innovative and do things. So I was talking to somebody about Toys R Us, and they were saying, well, you know, even if they get the money, what are they going to do? They're selling toys. Everyone's using tablets these days. Kids don't necessarily want toys, you know. And I said, you know, this is amazing because I'm not smart enough to be their CEO, but Toys R Us owns Babies R Us. And I can't think of two categories that would be more fun to do something in a store with. You've got toys and babies. I mean, you can't think of something you can do a store when you've got toys and babies? I think I could do something. I mean, have you ever been to Legoland? Everybody wants to build something. So we have a coffee store, possibly a bar, a Lego, babies. I got it. I think we could do something with these stores. Thank you very much. Any questions, thoughts?
Let me ask a question, Amanda. That stalking marketing, which does really annoy all of us, is that going to wane or is it going to still?
Retail only survives by, we are the king and queen of this, by the way. The only things that survive in retail are whether we like them, okay? So enough of us have got to like something to keep it. If you get irritated by, which I do, I send them on a customer service email going, dear whoever it is, love you very much. Would you stop stalking me with that pair of shoes right now? I'll never buy another. They send me the biggest apologies, like, stop it. Because they've figured out this way of marketing. They're so pleased with themselves they can do it. Now they've realized it doesn't actually work that well. They do too much of it too often, and it's driving people crazy. So I think you'll see it.
That's a very good tip. I'm going to do that too.
Hi, thanks for an interesting presentation. I used to work for what used to be a newspaper.
Oh, yeah, I remember those. Yeah.
The news business is desperately trying to come up with a model, a viable model for the future. And I guess I'd ask you to talk a little bit more about young shoppers and their buying habits. My son-in-law, I don't know the last time he's been in a store. I mean, he just completely relies online. And I'm just wondering, that market share, 11% online, must be growing.
It must
be on the upswing, and others are on the downswing. And I'm wondering, is what you're describing sounds kind of like rearranging or repositioning, but maybe what we really need to be looking at is a completely new model.
I think the model of what we're all trying to buy and sell something obviously remains, right? Which is the fundamental model of business or news or whatever it is, right? I think what is changing is how we're doing it, right? So I think it's my analogy would be like we move from the horse and cart to the car, right? We still got places in the horse and cart. We got there along a lot slower, and we had to fix the horse in a whole different way than we fixed the car. This is not a good analogy, but never mind. I'll keep going. Okay, but you know, so I think we still want news. We still want clothes. We still want food. We still want furniture. We still want beauty products. We still want these things and need them. And the difference between want and need is a whole nother class that I can give you. No, but how we get them is what's how we get them is what's interesting. So even with the younger generation, so I teach now 19-year-olds at 11 o'clock this morning. Okay, so 19-year-olds still go to stores. People don't think they do. Yes, they do. Not so many men go to stores at 19, by the way. But not so many men go to stores in total. Unless it's a golf store, Bass Pro. There's certain things you guys do like to go to. But in general, women still like to go, but they like to go because it's going to be fun. They like to go because they need to actually see and touch and do something. They like special things. They don't like to be in a mass of things. So they don't like this massive idea of a store with loaded and loaded with racks of merchandise that they wander through trying to find something that seems to be for them. They want to have it edited, curated, selected down so that they can go, okay, that's supposed to be what I'm looking at. I don't know if I'm answering your question well enough, but I think in a way, that's how they get their movies. It's how they get their news. It's how they get everything. It's a curated version, you know. But they are reading. I mean, they read the business news online. They're required to by Whitman most of the time. They don't. We have physical papers in the building that you'll see students reading occasionally, but most of the time they're on their tablets reading.
Very good presentation. I think you'd be a good presenter no matter what your subject was. But you seem to be focusing on individual companies and how they're reinventing themselves to be still appealing to people that show up. How does that fit in with the malls that seem to be as a place to go to is not so much for a lot of places?
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, and I think there's a parallel to it, right? So the malls have either got to reinvent themselves or they're going to start to die because the way they sit at the moment, the traditional mall with four or five anchor stores, a rather pizza-laden food court stuck in the middle with some questionable bathrooms off the side, are not going to survive. I'm sorry, they're just not. You've got to have a compelling reason. That's not fun. It's just not fun. I mean, you can go to outlet malls down in North Carolina that are fun. Right, where they make them look like a fabulous hotel. They've got little restaurants all over the place. They've figured out how to do it, where you go and you wander around, you have lunch, it's lovely. But the old enclosed, you know, sort of mall with the fluorescent lighting, you know, and the food court, I think its days are going to be very numbered unless it reinvents itself. I don't think any of us much want to go there. I don't think it's just youth. I just don't think it hasn't moved forward. We've stayed with the same model too long. Do you know? It's like looking at a kitchen which has Harvest Gold and avocado fixtures in it. You know, you look at it and go like, huh, I think we might want to go to stainless steel. Do you know what I mean? There's like a moment in there where like, I think these were here in 1956. And I think that's a model that a lot of malls are still with, and they, you know, definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. And we've got to do something different if you want to make a place that you and I want to go and shop or hang out at, or, you know, I think it's you've hit it on the head. You've got to be different.
Hi, I'm Andrea Wandersee. I'm the managing director of Open Hand Theater, and we have just moved into one of those lovely mall establishments. We're at Shopping Town Mall, and I'm going to do some shameless self-promotion. Please join us next Thursday from 5:30 to 7:30 at our grand reopening. It's a free event. We'd love to have you come see our new space. It is really cool. But my question is, technically I have two questions. I kind of have three. So one is, you're talking about Target and Crate and Barrel and organizations with a huge amount of resources. And Open Hand Theater wants to recreate itself and create this interactive place that kids will come to. And, you know, if you've been to that community corridor in the mall, there's a lot going on in that one corridor. There's nothing in the rest of the mall. There's not even a food court. So if you are a local nonprofit establishment with very thin resources, I mean, are there ideas, are there ways to make this happen when you don't have the website resources and you don't have, you know, these big marketing dollars? On that note, I get a call from several SU professors every year, I'm sure I'm not alone, wanting people to do internships, and they're never subjects I need. Now, your students I need. So could we talk?
We could.
And then thirdly, and this is more of a personal issue, what's your take on Barnes & Noble? Are they going to make it?
Wow. I'm so old, I can't remember the first part of that question. But anyway, let me go. Where do we say? Oh, yeah. Oh, the open hand. I think you're actually very smart. And I think in Shopping Town, that's actually one of the best geographical locations around here. That's a tragedy that that mall didn't work. And it didn't work because it didn't have an innovative enough developer to make it work, frankly. It's a fantastic location. It's a fabulous location. Most of us would love to go there. We're close to Wegmans. We're close to really great neighborhoods. Now, I don't have any money, but I don't know why someone doesn't take that and make it a mixed-use community slash, like, with residential, with retail, with restaurants, with condos. I mean, it's a... Keep the library. It's a perfect... Knock most of the building down because, again, it looks like it was built in the era of the avocado refrigerator. And make it into something that is really lovely. Its location is great. But don't... All I've seen since I've lived in Syracuse is them trying to reinvent it as the same mall it was before. That clearly is not working. But the things they do put in there, because there's the gymnastic thing, and there's... That's working. You see, the cars out there are going to those things. There's a play, that's a use for a mall. A mall is, in a way, like the old, we call high streets, main street, right? But you've got to make it more like a main street and make it fun and have it so it's personable, not just plate glass fronted stores with the food court, which is the model we came up, which worked quite well, but it's not working anymore. So I think what you're doing there is it's a really great space for you and you should hang out. Okay, that was first. What was the second thing? We can talk about students, second. Okay, Barnes & Noble, that was it, right? Barnes & Noble. I think if anyone's going to survive, they're going to survive. I'm not sure you're going to see the size of the stores as big as they are now. I think they may start shrinking in size. Their relationship with Starbucks was also extremely smart, okay, because they give you a place to hang for the 8 months of winter where you can hang out with a real piece of news or something and a cup of coffee and not feel pressured. Right, and that's very nice. I'm guessing they would probably survive. I don't know if they'll survive in the number of stores that they have. You know, the news, the report of all the books going out and being online was also a death that was somewhat exaggerated, that no one would actually buy a physical book anymore, that we would all buy, you know, we'd read them on our Nooks or Kindles or Dindles, whatever they are. You know, we'd all do that. Apparently not quite happening. We're still printing books out there. People, many people still like actually to hold a book, to look at the cover of a book. I went onto the Kindle route myself for about 6 months. I found I was buying the same book over and over again because I'm a visual person and I couldn't remember names. I can only remember the covers. And halfway through a book, I'd go, I'm pretty sure I know this story. Why is that? And then I realized I just bought the same thing. Oh, good Lord. And I never did that before, but it was so bizarre because I remember a book, and that bookmarking thing doesn't work, you know, where you book. And I like flipping back and forth and all the rest of it. It's for everything. You go like, who is this character again? How do I know? I have to go back and find out who he is, right? So I think there's still a love for that. Along with that, all this technology that we're using, which is, as you can tell, is not perfect, and it's not perfect anywhere, right? It's not perfect anywhere. There is actually a growing love for real things by everybody, for real food, for gardening. Do you know what the increase in the expenditure on pets is like in the last 10 years? It's amazing. It's one of the pets. I mean, people are going nuts buying things for their doglets and catlets. It's incredible what the money is being spent, because there is part of us that, for all this technology, for the hours we're spending online with those shoes following us around, right? We want to go home and like curl up with our lab, right? And have and learn how to prune a rose and understand how to make a cake from scratch. And there's definitely a move there. If I ask my 19-year-olds, who are fabulous, by the way, what they watch after they've watched a whole bunch of shows that I've never heard of, you know what they tune into when things get boring? The Food Channel. Have you ever gone into the Food Channel? Because it's just so much fun to watch. I really don't think when I was 19 I was watching people cook. I wasn't. But I think that this is what they're... So there's this kind of, I think, balance in our lives between understanding and perfecting technology and also looking to things that are actually real and visceral and touchable and saying these are important too. And how do we get back to that for young people, not just for older people like myself? For young people, they want to do things. They want to learn how to paint. They want to learn how to cook. And even though they're, you know, taking degrees in whatever, you know. So I think there's a change there. So I think there's hope for spaces where there is a place where people can be experience things. So Barnes & Noble created an experience early that you didn't just buy a book. You could experience a book in there, and that's different.
Rambling. To Amanda's point about Shopping Town, the Town of DeWitt Planning Commissioner says that is what the future of Shopping Town will be, is mixed-use space. So stay tuned.
I don't even know the gentleman, so that's great.
Good morning. I'm a big fan of Amazon Prime. We're members, and we buy everything from nail polish to dog food through there. Question for you is, you know, how do you see other retailers competing with that? And we pay $100 a year for the privilege of the two-day delivery. Do you think there's a limit to what people are willing to pay for such a thing?
Yes, I do. I think it's a great question. So Amazon Prime, so if you look at the income statement for Amazon, which looks pretty healthy, and people are really giving Amazon whatever it wants right now, I would forecast that's not going to happen forever. Most of the income in terms of profit is not from their retail operation. They're buying your business. Their income is coming from their cloud operating systems in the main. Their retail business is very small in terms of profitability. But they're big enough to be able to buy it. And that's working. And who wouldn't want to order nail polish and get it delivered for free in 2 days? I got it. So a couple of thoughts on that. One, it's not really very sustainable what we're doing. It's kind of awful what we're doing. Shipping toothpaste on 2-day delivery, what are we thinking, right? Just think about it. It's a little sad. I mean, there is a store around the corner. You know, you could actually go and buy it. Anyway, never mind. But secondly, everyone's on the bandwagon, to your point. Everyone's doing it. So, you know, everyone's got this. Macy's just signed a deal. Everyone's signing a deal for this instant delivery. I'm guessing in some ways it's a race to the bottom on margin. They're doing it because they have to. But in the end, we're going to have to pay for it somewhere. In the end, whatever you want, you can't have it free and now. Because that's what ultimately, if we really went down to it, what would we all want? Whatever we wanted now and free. Okay, that's what people ultimately want, right? That's how people think. It's not going to work. You can't maintain a business doing that. So how long they're going to keep doing that for? It's sort of like the ATM model. Do you remember when ATMs were first put in? You never had to pay to take money out, your own money out of a bank in an ATM. Now you do. They figured out they couldn't keep that going for long. So I don't know how long it'll last, but everyone's going to try these delivery models because they're desperately trying to stay in business and compete. And you can't argue with that. But at some point, I don't know how long that's sustainable, not only in terms of the environment, but it's sustainable in terms of if your profit margins. And I'm not a finance person, so I'm not smart enough to know where that's going to go. But I can't believe you can do that forever and ever and ever without there becoming an end to that.
I walk into Lowe's. I know exactly what the product is that I want. I tell the manager of a particular department. He says, I don't have it in the store, but There is one in Allbirn that I can get. It's the only other one in our entire district. He said, I live in Allbirn. I'm going to bring it in tomorrow. Come here at 10 o'clock. I did. I got my product. How do retailers train their people, or are they training their people that work for them, customers, how to answer their questions?
I think that's a wonderful example of some really good retailing, because you just told everyone, so now people will be thinking, I think I need something for my bathroom. I think I'll go to Lowe's today, and that's more powerful than any ad you could run. They're working very hard at training their associates, all of them, and it's tough to do because they're mainly part time. Because that's how the world is. Nobody, you know, it's not necessarily a career job anymore. It is a big challenge training associates, but when they turn over so quickly to do things. However, I like to look, your gentleman at Lowe's is a great example of what I call the Nordstrom model, where you don't actually hire people for their knowledge, you hire them for their attitude. So Nordstrom's model is not based on giving you everything now for free. At all. Everything is really quite expensive, by the way. There's no free anything. But it's all delivered. The experience makes people pay for it, right? Because they are unbelievably nice people. That's the only way I can tell you. You walk into a Nordstrom, these people, like the gentleman at Lowe's, take extraordinary care of you. They get to know you if you're a regular customer. Every Nordstrom customer knows that they probably could find something similar to this at another store at a discount. They're not like all brainwashed. I mean, they know that this exists, but they still go back. And you know what they're going back for? They're going back for service, human interaction and service. That's what they stand for. That's all they stand for. They take anyone. I have a great story. I was at visiting the Northeast VP for Nordstrom down in New Jersey, and we went out to get a quick lunch in the mall at a local eatery, and this young man came to serve us lunch, and he came over, and he was very charming, and he said, good morning, and he started to chat and said something. We're looking, and I'm watching her, and I'm thinking to myself, what a delightful young man. He really has a great attitude. She had hired him by the end of lunch. She had hired him by the end of lunch. There were business cards flying. He hadn't even got the bill on the table. She was like, now, Jeffrey, 3 o'clock, my office. We have a future for you. And he's going, yes, ma'am. I'll be there. Yes, ma'am. Fascinating, because their job is to look for people that they believe would be great with customers and enjoy that interaction. So I waffled on as usual. Sorry. But I think what you've experienced is the best of retail, and that's what makes people want to go and have an interaction. My need to go and have that sort of interaction is I don't know what I want when I go to Lowe's. You see, I'm the opposite. I go and it go, it's a thingy. It's about this big. It's stuck on the bottom of the loo, and I can't get it off. I don't know what it is, but I think I need a new one. That's all I've got. You know, and if someone goes, oh, I can help you, and starts to, I'm like, genius, you know, because I don't know what it is. So I think the combination of having someone there, I can't buy that thing online. I don't know what I'm looking for. Do you know, I wouldn't even know what to type in on the search thing. Little round thingy, bottom of loo, not going to help me. You know, like. So I think there is still plenty of time where you can see it in specialty stores. They tend to be strong at this. They understand customer relationships. They understand bringing things to customers in fitting rooms. They understand how that works. They understand being pleasant. There's still a lot to be said from walking out of a store, having a good experience. It raises one's little soul a little bit, just a little bit. There's a little piece of you that goes, that was a good day. And I think that's still part of the human experience. I don't think you get quite that feeling online yet.
Can you give us a couple of examples about Whitman School teaching entrepreneurial management?
Sure. So, okay, flip over. So, yeah, so we're a school that is a business school, right? We're the business school at SU. So we train students who are going to be accountants, and they're going to go into finance. They're going to go into marketing positions, into retail companies, whatever. But there's a theme within the school of entrepreneurship that runs pretty strong. And so Peggy and I know each other from something that we do every semester. So every semester, every senior at Whitman, regardless of their major, even if they're an accounting major or a finance major, has to take a capstone course. And that's the capstone course for the whole school. And in it, they're put into groups of four or five students. There's hundreds of them, so there's masses of sections going. And where they're asked to come up with an original business idea within 4 weeks, and then by the end of the 15 weeks, write an entire plan for it with all the financials and everything. They have to get testimonials from like businesses that this would work. They have to put together a board of advisors. They have to do all kinds of things. And then they stand in front of judges in their teams and present one after the other on Friday nights and Saturday mornings. And that's what Peggy and I sit next to each other. And then we pick the winners of each room, and then they go through to another league, and then there's eventually a winner at the top. The idea of this is that whatever your specialty is, even if you're going to, you know, go on and take the CPA, okay, you really need to know as a business person what every part of business is. And you really need to have an entrepreneurial mindset in order to be successful, right? Because things change are changing very fast. And we want our students to understand that even though, you know, you're going to go and work for Ernst & Young as an accountant, which is a wonderful thing. They are looking for young people who have that entrepreneurial mindset. So our concept in the classroom is to make sure that's delivered to every student. And then outside the classroom, we have a hatchery. It's called the Curry Hatchery, where we have 107 student businesses currently being run out of Whitman in their spare time. And those are Whitman students and students from all over the campus that we encourage to come in, and we give them help with legal advice, with finance advice. With some of them are very small, some of them go on to Shark Tank. You know, there's a whole combination of the variety.
Please join me again in thanking Dr. Nicholson. Thank you.